shows across the country, around the world, on the radio, and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films Ghostbusters Afterlife, King Richard, The Power of the Dog, Cowboy Bebop, and Home Sweet Home Alone. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup featuring a look back at the 2016 Ghostbusters. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/Kevin Carr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Because you had the Disney Plus Day 2021, there was a whole slate of new Disney stuff that was released and announced. And I think the big takeaway to this is showing that Disney is doubling down on the stuff that was popular and successful back in 2021 throughout the year, as well as delivering original content, not just TV versions of stuff, but movies as well. Now, of course, the big stuff that they are spinning off of are their Star Wars content. The Obi-Wan Kenobi series got some first look images for 2022. It has a Darth Vader duel. There's no trailer yet for it, but more importantly, it's the stuff that's coming for the Marvel elements. You've got new images for Moon Knight and She-Hulk and Ms. Marvel. All these are live-action series, which are spinning off the live-action series they had with Loki and WandaVision. And speaking of WandaVision, Agatha Harkness is getting her own series. Agatha House of Harkness is going to be coming as a live-action series, continuing the character that Catherine Hahn played in WandaVision, and she's going to be in this series as well. Now, one of the things that you're seeing even more of is some more animated stuff coming out from Marvel. You're getting an animated Spider-Man freshman year series, which is galvanizing the hold that Marvel has over Spider-Man, and that's always going to be tenuous because Sony has been trying to make its own universe, and of course we're getting that with Spider-Man No Way Home. I'm not going to be covering the trailer for that, by the way. That's going to get too spoilery. We're going to see the movie in a month. But, you know, trying to establish the Venom character and the Spider-Man series, but Marvel MCU still wants to do it with the animated stuff. You've got a Marvel Zombies animated series, and then you've got other MCU series that have been announced. They're rebooting the X-Men from 1997. You're getting Echo, I Am Groot, Ironheart, Secret Invasion, but not just the MCU stuff. You are going to have a new Baymax series. This is for kids coming in the summer of 2022. They got a trailer for that. They've got a Cars series with Owen Wilson and Larry the Cable Guy doing the voices. You've got a Tiana series, which is a spinoff of Princess and the Frog and Zootopia, and even Willow's getting an original series, which is kind of cool. I'm looking forward to that. But one of the things that I thought was interesting about the announcements that came out of Disney Plus Day was the theatrical stuff, because we still got the pandemic in the background, but people are moving back in the theaters, and theaters are seeing a resurgence and at least a return of some people. There's still stuff that's going to be coming to streaming. There's going to be a Predator prequel called Prey coming to Hulu in 2022. And then you've got announcements for Hocus Pocus 2, which is coming in Halloween of next year to Disney Plus. You've got a live-action Pinocchio with Tom Hanks, directed by Robert Zemeckis. That's coming to Disney Plus in 2022. Tom Hanks is turning into the star of streaming. You had him for Finch, you had him for Greyhound, you've got him for this Pinocchio movie. They've got an Ice Age movie coming in January for Disney Plus. Plus, they've got a Cheaper by the Dozen reboot, Disenchanted, which is a sequel to Enchanted, and a couple Diary of a Wimpy Kid movies that are all going to be on Disney Plus. So, you know, you're not just getting theatrical content in theaters, you're getting stuff coming to Disney Plus as theatrical features, and that's important because streaming is not going anywhere. They've built their ground, they've staked their territory, and they're going to keep doing stuff. I said this with Netflix last week. Now, when it comes to the box office, Eternals in the box office as a theatrical exclusive held actually pretty well. It dropped 62%, but that's kind of normal when it comes to a Marvel movie because those things tend to be somewhat front-loaded. But it still ended up with $27 million, and it should be able to leg it out to about $200 million domestically. And it's doing pretty well overseas, so it's going to probably end up with at least $500 million worldwide, which isn't bad, especially for a global pandemic. Clifford the Big Red Dog did actually quite well. Got a $17 million weekend, which was like 20-some million dollars for the five-day because it opened on Wednesday. But that was also a Paramount Plus release. So, you know, this might end up being the standard for family movies. They do well in theaters, but they're doing well given a home viewing option. And that's, I think, something people have always wanted, pandemic or not, because when you had a bunch of kids, you don't want to bring them to the theater and cause a disruption, and it's expensive. So if there is an at-home option, people will watch it, but you're going to have a certain crowd that's still going to go to the theaters. Now, Belfast had a slow start last week with less than $2 million in the box office, but you're going to see that ramp up, and that's going to have staying power throughout award season, especially if it gets some decent nominations, which I believe it's going to. So that slow start for Belfast doesn't mean the end of the road for it. It's still going to do well for the next several months. It's not going to burn out the way stuff like Dune or The Eternals is going to, because those are very front-loaded. Listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. We've got a couple new trailers out. The first one is from Downton Abbey, A New Era, which is a new Downton Abbey movie coming to theaters on March 18th.
Years ago, before you were born, I met a man. And now I've come into the possession of a villa in the south of France.
What?
They better be warned. The British are coming.
And with that, I will say goodnight and leave you to discuss my mysterious past.
I never really watched the show. But I watched the movie, and I thought they did a good job acclimating people who've never watched the series to the movie. There was a little preview that you could watch on YouTube that was like a 15-minute explanation of who all the characters were. And you know, I ultimately liked the Downton Abbey movie. I mean, I'm not a huge fan, but it certainly was charming, and I expect more of the same come March when this one comes out in theaters. There's also Seeing Red I want to talk about, which is the new Pixar movie coming out on March 11th.
I'm Maylin Lee. I wear what I want, say what I want, 24/7, 365.
Is everything okay?
I'm a gross red monster!
It's happened already?
What did you say?
Our ancestors had a mystical connection with red pandas.
Are you kidding me?
This little quirk runs in our family.
Any strong emotion,
yes,
will release the panda.
This is essentially an Asian version of Teen Wolf, where you got this girl who turns into a giant red panda rather than Marty McFly turning into a werewolf. The thing with this one, as charming as Pixar is, one of the dangers that I feel is coming out from the trailer is the girl is really obnoxious. She just screams through half of the trailer. And you get a little bit of taste of that. And there's only so much I can do with a screaming child. It just gets annoying. I understand that teenage girls will scream and over-emote, but there's a fine line between making that sympathetic in a movie and making that annoying in a movie. And it gets annoying in the trailer. So if they don't temper this, it's going to be an annoying movie. And it's going to move its outside of the Pixar charm. And while I have no problem with the premise and the story, and I love the idea that they're hopefully going to be exploring the complex world of emotions the way they did in Inside Out, I'm just afraid this is going to be a screeching child in a red panda. And that gives me a little bit of caution as this is coming to theaters and whether or not it's going to be any good. But we'll see. Who knows? Pixar has charmed me in the past, so I do have faith. Anyways, that's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Home Sweet Home Alone and King Richard. guys at the movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the movie reviews and talk about Home Sweet Home Alone. Disney Plus reboots the franchise in which a boy tries to defend his home from would-be burglars when he is left in suburban Chicago after his family flies to Tokyo.
My mom and dad have gone to Tokyo. I'm totally on my own.
You do realize that my 10-year-old son is at home by himself. You just assumed Max was on the other flight.
We didn't take a census.
We got reports of suspicious people around 36 Lincoln Ave.
I can't go to jail. And we're criminals.
I don't think so. This is my house. I have to defend it.
I was kind of interested in this when I first saw it, because I have a certain faith in Disney. I think some of their programming is actually quite good. And one of the things they've been doing with their Disney Plus movies is not just telling a Disney Channel story. Disney Channel was very much a cottage industry for tweens, and it didn't move outside of it that much, to the point that shows would last for 3 years, and they figure their audience grew up to teenagers and stopped watching them, so they'd always start new ones. And once they started putting stuff on Disney Plus, like what was that movie, Godmothered, a couple years ago? I thought that was really kind of clever. I thought that was cute. It felt like it was something that would have gone to theaters, but they moved to Disney Plus because it wasn't going to make $1 billion. And Home Sweet Home Alone, I thought, might be kind of fun. It stars Archie Yates, who most people don't know who he is. But he was in the movie Jojo Rabbit, actually. And I thought he was really hilarious in Jojo Rabbit, playing a young kid in the Hitler Youth, which the movie itself, you got to see Jojo Rabbit to understand that. But Jojo Rabbit was one of the best movies from 2 years ago. And Archie Yates, I thought, was very funny in it. He has sort of this young Nick Frost flair to him. The thing with this movie, though, is they don't give him the lovability. He kind of has an edge to him. And there was a vulnerability he had in Jojo Rabbit as the friend of the main character. But in this one, he's a little bit abrasive. He doesn't have the charm or the sweetness that a young Macaulay Culkin had in the original Home Alone. The other thing they do with this movie is the threat to him are these people in the neighborhood who think he's stolen something from their house. And so they're going to the house to try and get it back, and they don't realize he's there. So the threat's not an actual threat. It's just more he thinks they're coming after him. And so it's this case of mistaken identity, rather than the original Home Alone, where honest to God burglars, played by Joe Pesci and Daniel Stern, I mean, they were coming in to rob the house. And there's actually a point in the original Home Alone when they catch Kevin McAllister, and they are legitimately threatening his, at least his safety, if not his life. You don't get that threat because it's just this, when they're doing all the gadgets and the slapstick comedy and these people are getting injured trying to get in this house, they may not have the best of intentions, but they don't have malicious intentions. And so the movie itself kind of turns malicious because you're basically reveling in violence against these people who kind of have a right to go after what they're going after. Maybe they're just not doing it the right way. And so it's less fun to watch, you know, because these are essentially just a suburban couple trying to get something back that they own. So there was no sweetness to it. It's a little more nasty, and it's not as good-natured. And that's a shame, because I thought they could have done something good. Now, don't get me wrong, it's a Home Alone sequel. You know, you had Home Alone, Home Alone 2, Lost in New York. I've never seen Home Alone 2, Lost in New York. I've never seen the third one, which was apparently terrible. And then there was a fourth one I had seen that I'd gotten to review years ago that was a direct-to-video, and that thing's terrible. So this is better than that one. And I'm assuming it's better than Part 3. I don't know about Part 2. I've never seen it. But it doesn't have the same charm. It doesn't have the same sweetness. It doesn't have the same lovability that the original Home Alone had. So I'm going to have to say that Home Sweet Home Alone kind of sucks. Watch the original instead.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about King Richard. Will Smith stars as the father of Venus and Serena Williams, sticking to his preconceived plan to make his daughters star athletes.
Everything to go from prodigy to pro.
Raise your hand, Serena. Venus Williams.
What you think? Nobody's taking that bet. Tennis takes expert instruction.
It takes families with unlimited financial resources. It's like asking somebody to believe that you got the next two Mozarts in your house.
Venus and Serena gonna shake up this world.
Look, I don't know much about tennis. I don't follow tennis. I don't follow sports. I mean, I'm aware of who Serena and Venus Williams are. It's hard to not be. It's sort of like you know who LeBron James is, even if you don't follow basketball. Venus and Serena Williams are brilliant tennis stars, and they're great at what they do. But I never followed their career. So I don't know anything about Richard Williams. I apparently he was polarizing, and a lot of people disagreed with what he did. But obviously something worked because he ended up raising two daughters who are phenomenal tennis stars, arguably some of the best athletes on the planet. So, as I understand it, this is Venus and Serena Williams giving a love letter to their father and trying to show his side of the story, because most people who are even fans of Venus and Serena Williams took a lot of issue with some of the things that their father said, what their father did, and how he ran their careers. And there were a lot of disagreements, and he had sort of his own way of doing it. And I guess it sparked to say, well, look, it all worked out. And I guess it did. That doesn't mean you can't second guess what this guy had done. You know, sure, it's not good to heap fame on a 13-year-old kid because they're going to go insane. You end up with a Jennifer Capriati. But they do seem to be a little too close to this. And that's one of my big problems when you have biopics that are involved with the estate or the family or that actual person. That happened with Rocket Man because Elton John shouldn't have been involved in it. That happened with the movie Race about Jesse Owens. I mean, Jesse Owens is long gone, but his family helped work on that movie. So you got a certain level of the family spin to it rather than a movie that's made removed from the actual person that can objectively look at their life. And this is a fine movie. I mean, it's an uplifting story. It's an inspirational story. It's kind of neat to watch. It's, if you don't know anything like me, I don't know anything about Venus and Serena Williams, really, outside of the fact that they're tennis stars. So I could learn about their history and their story. And Will Smith does a fine job playing the role. It's a tough role because it's easy to fall into caricature. And he does, at times, fall into the caricature of this guy rather than playing an authentic version of him. But it's tough, so I give him kind of a pass to it. I mean, I'm not ready to award him the Oscar for it, which I think a lot of people are. But still, I think he does a fine job. It's not his best performance, but there you go. He's trying to win an Oscar. But the problem with this movie is, and the problem I have with most Will Smith movies recently, is you can't get past his ego. It's still about him. And you've got two of the best athletes on the planet. And it's not about those athletes. It's about their dad. I wrote this plan. I'm like, well, your wife has to give birth to two of the greatest athletes on the planet for this to even work. And at a certain point in the movie, it does become Venus's story, which I was really wanting to see. But then they have to keep cutting back to the father. And I'm like, it's not about him. Even though the movie is about him, I guess that's part of the problem. The movie shouldn't be about him. I have reservations. It's not a great movie. People are overhyping it. It's fine. I'll give it a kind of rocks, but I still have issues with this film.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Ghostbusters Afterlife and the Power of the Dog. Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the new film that I think everybody's really talking about this week, and that is Ghostbusters Afterlife. Jason Reitman directs a sequel about Egon Spengler's estranged daughter and grandkids who move into his home in small town Oklahoma, only to discover a building paranormal anomaly.
What are you doing here in Somerville anyway?
We're completely broke. And our grandfather left us this creepy old farmhouse in the middle of nowhere.
Your father wasn't much of a homemaker. He could hardly keep the power on.
You're saying he left us nothing?
Well, I wouldn't say nothing.
Somehow, the town with no fault lines is shaking on a daily basis.
Something's coming.
They'd been talking about making a Ghostbusters sequel for decades. They made Ghostbusters 2, which I've always said, when 2016 Ghostbusters came out, I go, you do realize there's only been one good Ghostbusters. Because Ghostbusters 2 really wasn't very good. It's okay. It's passable. And I remember seeing it in 1989 and thinking, okay, it was fine for a Ghostbusters sequel. But really, in terms of a story that's going to live, the original movie's still the best. So let's just acknowledge the fact that there was really only one genuinely good Ghostbuster movie ever made. So after the 2016 movie was a disappointment, it didn't inspire great confidence in the studio to continue that story. And so they completely rebooted it. And one of the things a lot of people didn't like about the 2016 is they said, well, it's stunt casting. Not that women can't be funny. It's that they said, well, we're going to do Ghostbusters, but we're going to make it wackety schmackety and put women in there. Make characters that are women. I don't care. But that just is a gimmick at that point of saying, we're going to make the female Ghostbusters. It's like, we're going to make the female Expendables or the female James Bond. Just do an authentic spy movie, cast a woman, and then just do a movie. So when the 2016 Ghostbusters didn't do well, they made this one and they announced it. And a lot of people took issue because they said, oh my gosh, another gimmick. They're just going to make the kid Ghostbusters, the teenage Ghostbusters. That's not what they do in this movie. And it's a relief because that's what I thought they were going to do, is just basically reassemble the Ghostbusters. They tell a different story. They do manage to thread the needle between being overly nostalgic. And to be fair, at times this leans too much into the nostalgia. I will 100% acknowledge that. I don't think that's going to hold up well for future generations. I mean, you're going to watch this movie in 10 years and be like, it's a little on the nose in terms of the nostalgia and what's been done before. But a little bit of that is forgivable. They just do it too much at times. But they do manage to have those moments and tell an original story and tell their own version. There's quite a big difference. It's a different group of characters that come together. It's not these paranormal researchers. They kind of stumble upon the Ghostbusters elements. And the other thing that's really neat about this movie is it takes place with the original Ghostbusters having existed. So you sort of leapfrog over the inevitable explanation of people arguing whether ghosts exist and having to prove it, and then have suddenly ghosts show up and they're just like, oh, okay, well, this happened once before. It happened in New York in the 80s and it was a while ago, but it's not out of the realm of possibility. So you don't have to fight the skeptical side of the movie, which makes it flow a little bit better. Cause they're watching YouTube clips of these guys fighting a giant marshmallow in New York City. And even though that's absurd, it happened, but it happened in the 80s and it hadn't happened since. So I think it manages to play its own tune, taking place in a small town in Oklahoma rather than New York City. And they didn't just take comedy stars, drop in the movies and say, do your thing. Which I think is part of the problem with the 2016 version. They just tried to ape the original concept even. Whereas this one, they tell the story and they cast the characters. It's not an overt comedy. It's not a laugh out loud. It has comedic moments and has some very funny moments. And you get that like with Paul Rudd's in it. So he's, of course, making his wise cracks, which he's good at. And the character of McKenna Grace plays, she plays Egon's granddaughter. And she's sort of this nerdy, withdrawn, very keeps to herself, possibly somewhere in the Asperger's syndrome spectrum. She's odd. So she says things that are very off-putting or weird. So she has some great, but she's authentically funny in her own right. She's not trying to be the Egon character or the Venkman character or anything like that. She's just who she is. And Finn Wolfhard plays her brother, and he has some funny lines, but they're more reactionary. But it's also not trying to do a Stranger Things version of Ghostbusters. That's what I think some people were afraid of. But it doesn't do that. It kind of tells its own story. It's the David S. Pumpkins of Ghostbusters movie. It's its own thing. And that's what I liked about it. It doesn't get too big. It doesn't overdo it. It doesn't try to just mimic the original, although they have a lot of stuff from the original. I was pleasantly surprised. I didn't know what to expect from this movie. And I went to go see it. I had low expectations. And honestly, I was impressed. I enjoyed it. I had fun. And I came out of the movie smiling. So I'm going to have to say, totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about The Power of the Dog. Jane Campion directs this tale of a conflicted and hard-willed cowboy building a strained relationship with his brother's new family.
What you doing?
Getting mixed up with her.
You are marvelous, Rose. We were married someday.
A man was made by patience and the odds against him.
For what kind of man would I be if I did not help my mother?
Peter!
If I did not save her.
Sort of a lonesome place out here, Pete. Unless you get in the swing of things.
This is going to be available on Netflix, I think, in about 2 weeks. Right now, it's in a limited theatrical run. They're, of course, trying to win awards with this one. This has a fantastic cast. You've got Benedict Cumberbatch playing the main character. You've got Kirsten Dunst, Jesse Plemons playing Cumberbatch's brother, and Kirsten Dunst plays his new wife, and Cody Smith-McPhee plays her son, who's odd and has his own predilections, and is teased and ridiculed by the other cowboys, but he's just trying to do his own thing. And it's this unlikely relationship that he builds with Benedict Cumberbatch's character, who is this, I wouldn't say grizzled, but he's hardened. He's this cowboy who works on the ranch, and he's very manly. And I mean, to the point that it also examines, one of the things this movie examines is it examines masculinity, what it means to be masculine, toxic masculinity, how it competes with femininity, to the point that, I don't want to give anything away, but there's elements to this movie that you watch that says, you know, at what point does being masculine go so far into being masculine that it actually crosses over? This movie is very, very dense. There's a lot of stuff that's woven throughout. What do you expect from Jane Campion? I mean, she's not this mainstream director who does pop movies at all. So it's based on a book. I've never read the book, but it has a lot of layers to it. And it takes its time. It's not a lickety-split fast movie, but it challenges the look at what it means to be a man, a woman, an adult, a child, what it means to be a person, what it means to be compassionate, what it means to, you know, carry a grudge. I mean, there's a lot of stuff built into this movie. It also takes place in like the 20s, but it's all the way out in Montana, so it could be the 1850s for all you know, except they have a car. Otherwise, it's the Old West, but it's really not the Old West because it's only about 100 years ago that this movie takes place. So it also has that out of time feel to it, where it's not, certainly not modern, but the world it exists in is more modern than you think it is, which makes it rather interesting. And there's some fantastic performances. I've seen this movie once. I want to watch it again because there's a lot of stuff you aren't going to catch the first time around. So, I mean, it's complex and it's deep and it's absolutely worth seeing. And I think you're going to see this continuing through as a potential award film, you know, best of the year type stuff. I don't know if I would count it as a best of the year, but it certainly is a great movie. If you can catch it in theaters right now, or you can wait until it comes into Netflix in a couple weeks, but it's absolutely worth checking out. So I'm going to say The Power of the Dog rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Cowboy Bebop and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring a look back at the 2016 Ghostbusters.
Who let the dogs out?
Hooter, 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 hooter.
Who let the dogs out?
Hooter, 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 hooter.
Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews and actually do a TV review. But let's talk about Cowboy Bebop. Netflix launches this live-action reboot of the classic 1998 anime about interplanetary bounty hunters.
Hey, there's a new bounty on the line.
Worth the trouble?
You want to keep the lights on around here?
Where did we find this dipstick?
We'll handle this one.
On our own.
Not a chance.
Not that way! Bang!
I got him.
That's not the bounty.
I got him.
That's not the bounty either.
What the f***?
before I saw this, I really hadn't watched much Cowboy Bebop beforehand. There's one season of anime, and you can get it on Netflix. It's on Netflix right now. But it's also one of those classic animes. You know, I mean, you're talking about like going back to the era, not as old as Akira, but still that 90s anime. Before anime really made the leap to the American, I don't even know if it's even in the American mainstream, but pre-internet and pre-digital distribution of stuff, it was very hard to get anime. You'd have to go find like specialty stores. But eventually when it kind of caught on and you had YouTube and you had Netflix and everything, now there's a lot of teens out there. My kids watch anime and they love it. And it's funny because I was talking to my son Ben, and he's a huge anime fan. He's 18. And I told him, I said, well, here's what I don't like about anime. And I listed a bunch of things that are just sort of tropes in anime that I don't like. And he was laughing because he's like, it's clear you've watched enough anime because you're nailing exactly what are elements of anime. There's a lot of frozen moments and there's a lot of overblown effects that then just kind of linger on screen. And there's weird dialogue moments and grunting and noises there's a lot of stuff that happens in anime that I don't think would work in live action, but somehow it works in anime. But there's weird things that happen in anime that nobody questions. Like you can have a 12-year-old be the CEO of a company and people are like, okay, that's kind of absurd. So anyways, I watched a couple episodes of the original Cowboy Bebop in preparation for this. And then I watched the Netflix version. I gotta say, I like the Netflix version. I will absolutely admit that making the leap from anime to live action is awkward. It's like adapting a comic book into a movie. In terms of how long they've been making superhero content for the screen, it took about 60, 70 years for comic book movies to actually come into their own, and they've kind of figured out how to do the outfits and the special effects to make it work and not look stupid. You know, you go back and you watch like the old Captain America serials or the old Batman serials, and they look dumb. They like really look rudimentary. And even like the 1960s Batman, as goofy as that is in camp, it worked because it's camp, but you couldn't have done a authentic version. You even look back at the old Incredible Hulk. It really is. It's clunky. It doesn't click. And it took them a while, and digital effects had to come into play. But anime, they've tried anime more. And, you know, I know Scarlett Johansson's not Asian, and that was an issue people had with Ghost in the Shell. But even Ghost in the Shell, there's clips of Ghost in the Shell that look like they're drawn right out of the original anime. They're just reshot. But somehow they don't quite work. And the production design doesn't quite work in a live-action setting. I tend to like it. I think the production design in Cowboy Bebop is really cool. But I'm not married to the anime version of it. And I know there's a lot of people who don't like the way the characters work. They like the actors. The actors are really good. I mean, John Cho as Spike Spiegel, the main character in Cowboy Bebop, I think he does a great job. The actors in the show, I'm fine with. But then again, as I mentioned, I'm not a big fan of anime. I think it's an imperfect version of the source material because the source material is made to be anime. But I think it's the closest you're going to get to live action. Yeah, it's a little bit goofy. Yeah, it feels very cartoony, but it's literally made from a cartoon. I enjoy this one. I think it's pop, it's crazy, it's over the top, it's bright, it's colorful. Some of the action doesn't quite click. I think they should have undercranked the camera a little bit more for some stuff. I personally liked it, but I'll absolutely admit it is not an exact replica of the anime. But that's because, you know, they're two different, very different mediums. So I'm going to say I liked Cowboy Bebop, although I know that there's a lot of people who take reservation. But I'll still say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Today's spotlight is going to be on the 2016 Ghostbusters. Paul Feig directs this female-led cast of metaphysical researchers who discover a convergence of paranormal events that threaten New York City.
We have a gift. We see what no one else is willing to see. We do things others can't do.
Ghostbusters.
If there's a paranormal problem, we're the ones to answer the call.
Hello.
What do we think of these Ghostbusters? Are they to be taken seriously?
There's a bigger picture at hand here.
Someone is creating a device that amplifies paranormal activity.
This movie, I think, was doomed from the start because they announced it as a, we're going to do an all-female version of Ghostbusters, which just reeks of stunt casting. Then there was this pushback of people, what, you say women can't be funny? And then they made a very unfunny movie and it became this weird self-fulfilling prophecy. But it's been 5 years. I saw it once in the theaters. I thought it was, okay. And I went back and I watched it because for some reason I ended up with a digital copy of the movie. And it does not hold up. And you start immediately seeing, 5 years down the road, where the problems are. What made the original Ghostbusters work is it was an authentic science fiction-y kind of story. And then what they did is they just cast these comedians in the roles. And they let them sort of be themselves in the roles. But there was still a relationship to the material. As goofy as Bill Murray is in Ghostbusters, there's a sense that Peter Venkman cares about things. Like Venkman, when he brings back Sigourney Weaver's character and she's clearly insane and she's going through this transformation process and he's like, look, I'm going to leave you here. I'm not going to take advantage as much as I'd like to. I'd like to say I'm the Keymaster or whatever. He's a good guy. And there's like that scene where the Marshmallow Man steps on a church and Venkman goes, nobody steps on a church in our town. And I'm like, I love that scene because as goofy of a line as that is, and as over the top and as Peter Venkman of a line, it's still a very New York, no, you cross the line. You don't do that crap in my hometown. So you got the sense that as much of a goofball as Venkman was, he still cared. Now, what they did in this movie is, I think they started with the actors, and I think that's part of the problem. They didn't write a good story and then put the characters in. I think they built it around them, which was a problem because then you were trying to make the story work based on what the actors were rather than telling a good story and then putting the actors on top. So you had basically two types of actors in this movie. You had the over-the-top crazy ones, and then you had the mumblecore sort of kind of out of the corner of your mouth kind of talking comedy. And those were so vastly different because that's what Kristen Wiig certainly was, as well as, to a degree, Melissa McCarthy. And then on the other hand, you had Kate McKinnon and Leslie Jones. But Kate McKinnon, I think this is, as much as everyone loved Kate McKinnon when she first was in the movie, I watch it now and I'm like, oh no, she's bad. She's terrible in it. Because I think this is the first time she was given a chance to do anything outside of Saturday Night Live and she wanted to do it as much as possible. Her character is so over the top, you can't take it seriously. And if you can't take her character seriously, how do you think the character is taking anything in the movie seriously? So the character's just an agent of chaos. And it's so over the top and so ridiculous, and there's no grounding to it. And then you throw in Leslie Jones, who, I'm sorry, Leslie Jones is not a movie star, and she's obnoxious. Her whole shtick of this screaming woman is not funny. And I know she does embody that loud, brash African-American woman. But there's a reason why Tiffany Haddish has a good career in movies and Leslie Jones doesn't. Because there's something relatable about Tiffany Haddish, and there's something abrasive about Leslie Jones. And that's not a knock on Leslie Jones. That's just kind of what she plays. She's just so loud and obnoxious. And then on the other side, you've got Kristen Wiig kind of mumbling through all of her stuff and acting awkward and weird. And then you've got Melissa McCarthy sort of trying to strike a balance between that. She's struggling to do this, but then she's like, they have like 8 jokes about soup in this movie. That should have been a red flag there. At some point, somebody at Sony should have been like, why are we telling so many jokes about soup? I mean, it's a beautiful looking movie. It's got great effects. I mean, it's gorgeously shot. It's just awkward and painful to watch. It's not funny. I did not find myself. I laughed way more at Ghostbusters Afterlife. I mean, McKenna Grace got more laughs out of me in that movie than any of these women. I go back and watch this 2016 Ghostbusters, and I say it kind of sucks now.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
And that's it. I need to go. When I come back next week, I'm going to be talking about House of Gucci and Encanto. And until then, have a fat time at the movies or at home.